I think this emotional connection to food, a resonance we find in food, an attraction to food that isn't about how crispy or crunchy it is, but is about the story embedded in the food. I think that's universal.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and our guest today is fascinating, extraordinary, and I'm so grateful he's here with us. His name is John T. Edge. He writes and hosts the Emmy award-winning TV series True South, which airs on the SEC Network, ESPN, Disney, and Hulu. He also writes a restaurant column for Garden Gun and his 2017 book, The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South, was named one of the best books of the year by NPR and Publishers Weekly. John T. serves as the University of Mississippi as a teacher, a writer in residence, and director of the Mississippi Lab. He also serves at the University of Georgia as a mentor in their low residency MFA program in narrative nonfiction. We're here today to talk about his newest book, House of Smoke. I read it. It's a fantastic read, and I'm so excited to get into it. John T., welcome to the Daily Helping. It is awesome to have you with us today.
I'm glad to be with you. That's a heck of a introduction. I'll take it. Thank you, Dr. Richard.
There's a lot to live up to in there. So, you know, no pressure, John T. So, you know, this is funny because I do this, you know, I've done this hundreds of times now and over the past 8 years. And I always ask people, tell me their superhero origin story. You know, what was it that put them on their path today? But your book is that story. So I'm not going to ask that question, but I am going to ask you, you know, high level, how would you describe House of Smoke overall, and why did you feel the need to write it?
I think this book, you know, and readers tell you what your book is, no matter what you might think it is. And some of this is informed by a book tour, which is just coming to a close. I think this book is about the stories I inherited from my family, from the South, from the historical marker in front of our home growing up, in my attempt to rewrite those stories. I'm a writer by trade, but I mean this in the larger metaphorical sense of making a new self, making a better self, and hopefully contributing to a better South by taking the stories I inherited, rethinking them, retooling them, rewriting them.
I think what's interesting about this book is that it forces the reader to confront identity and what we inherited about our identity. You know, you grew up in a house that was just drenched in Confederate legacy, right? And you mentioned that when you were a little boy, that, you know, you kids would reenact, you know, the war, and it was kind of glorified. And I think for a lot of us, we're shaped in so many ways by these family stories that get passed down. So, you know, I'm curious, as we think about a home, right? And home means different things for different people. We inherit home. We inherit these stories, these myths. I'm curious, what is your understanding of what home means to you as you kind of looked at these myths embedded in your childhood?
You know, my childhood was a long time ago. You know, if we're describing a scene in which I took as gospel the words on the historical marker in front of our house, that's 50 plus years ago. So, you know, my ideas have changed, but the home of my childhood was the home of a Confederate brigadier general, where a Confederate brigadier general, a boy who would grow up to be a Confederate brigadier general, took his first breath. And that was, in many ways, the defining story of my home, that I inherited that legacy, though there was no blood that ran my veins that had any connection to the blood that ran his veins. My mother's want for story to embellish our own family story linked us. A relative of Alfred Iverson, the eventual Confederate Brigadier General, wrote a book, he's a painter, wrote a great book I admire called The Paternal Suit. He wrote in that book to me, united not by blood, but by story. In a lot of ways, to grow up a white boy in small town Georgia like I did was to take on those Confederate narratives and wrap them around your shoulders like a shawl. And what I've learned in the days and weeks and months and years since is the way in which those stories do harm. To carry those stories forward does harm. And I've seen it in the impact on my own life and the way I think about myself. And I see it in the way that white Southerners treat black Southerners. And I see it in the language we use when people still sort America between Confederates and Yankees. I mean, this kind of stuff is still alive in our everyday conversation.
You know, it's interesting. I think anybody listening to this, this is a great opportunity to think about, you know, how our inherited narratives are driving us. You know, what are the stories that serve us? What are the stories, if we really looked at them, we would probably do well to get rid of, right, moving forward? So I found that to be powerful as I was reading through your book. You and I mentioned this off air, both have an unreasonable, probably, love of food. And, you know, food became a thing for you that really shaped your life. You know, you went to college, didn't really work out at UGA, you know, a little too much alcohol, too much partying there. But you found your way to Atlanta. You worked these corporate-y kind of jobs, right, where you're driving around doing stuff. And then you found your way back in Mississippi, or not back, but in Mississippi. And you find your way back to school and then ultimately into food. And, you know, having spent over the last 20 years a lot of my life in Georgia, I understand, and I am not from the South. I am as Midwestern comes. But I understand there's just a difference to food here. So I want to first ask you this question, because this isn't in your book, but you've been around the food world long enough where I think you are certainly an authority in this. Why do you think there is such an emotional connection to food in the South that may not exist to this degree in other regions of this country?
I mean, first I'll say that I think this emotional connection to food, a resonance we find in food, an attraction to food that isn't about how crispy or crunchy it is, but is about the story embedded in the food, I think that's universal. I believe it's a Chinese philosopher, I'm going to get it wrong, but you know, the quote is, what is nostalgia, what is patriotism but nostalgia for the food of our youth? And so I might disagree with you on the supremacy of the Southern stance on this, but I will say that the narrative that food gets us to in the South, and one of the reasons food matters so much to people in the South, even if they don't recognize the root of it, I would argue is that, you know, when you study any creative output from the American South, it takes you straight to race. It takes you straight to the imprint of racism on the American South. Because for the longest time in the American South, the people who did the hard work, whether that's the labor of pulling in the crops or the cooking of the food, for the longest time, a lot of that labor that went unthanked, unpaid, was black labor. And that takes us to the heart of the reason, I think, that food stirs so many emotions, especially in the South.
That's certainly fair. I found it very interesting. You were talking, which I would have never considered, how tamales crossed over to African-American culture because so many African-Americans migrated to go do factory work and such. And then they had to hire the people who had these, you know, plantations had to hire Hispanic workers, and the cultures kind of shifted. I mean, that was fascinating to read. And this
that's
book
the
was
1890s. That's the 1890s.
That's nuts
I mean,
to me.
That sounds like something that happened
Right.
last week.
So that's very interesting to me. So you're talking about food, that food in the South, it has this component of racism to it. So it's both, it's comfort, it's familiarity, it's nostalgia, to quote your Chinese philosopher. But it's got this confrontational piece of it, right, that has to be reconciled. So how does one reconcile that?
I don't know if one needs to reconcile. I just would ask that people be aware to recognize that the food we define broadly as Southern is very much West African. Whether that's, you know, the fried okra that you might eat at a meat and three restaurant in suburban Atlanta, way out in the suburbs, or whether that's a gumbo thickened with ropey cooked okra. Both, as my friend and mentor Jessica Harris would say, okra points its green tip toward Africa. There's so many ways in which, if you study our food, if you eat our food, then you recognize the common bonds between black and white, between people of many places and many different backgrounds. Food's one way to come into the fullness of that, to become aware of that. And I think that's part of the power of food.
I think it's interesting, too. I've heard many times, and this would often come up during the Olympics, where, you know, Russians are there and we're there and there's conflict. And, you know, Bob Costas or somebody like that would always say sports is the great unifier. But I think it's food more so than sports, right? I mean,
I think it's both. I mean, yeah. You know, here I make a television show about food culture and it's on a sports network. There's something in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to shift. One of the things that I also took from this book is you really embrace vulnerability and emotional growth. A lot of that had to do with grief and loss, and this showed up in a couple of ways, several ways throughout the book. So let's talk about that in particular, grief and loss, right? You had something crazy happen in your house and somebody died and your parents got divorced and your mother struggled with alcoholism. So how did grief and loss for you really propel your own journey and your own growth?
I guess in a lot of ways, those events left me either bewildered or angry, or oftentimes a little bit of both. And I wanted to quit being bewildered and angry. you know, the friends I admire the most move through the world with a kind of kindness that affects others whom they encounter. And I wanted more of that in my life. And I think that led me to realization of telling the truth about my family and about my story and about my growth. I mean, I think it's important to say, here I stand in the year 2025, and I was born in 1962, and, you know, came up with ideas about the Confederacy that are so far removed from my ideas now. That it's jarring, but to sketch that change in myself and my change in my perspective and my move toward a want to drop anger and embrace love, like that to me is the, you know, the ongoing attempt of all of us.
I love that. The best definition of anger anybody ever said to me was anger is like swallowing poison and expecting somebody else to get ill.
That's great. That's great.
And I think that's a metaphor for that people can use today. We have so many people today who wake up in 2025. They're predisposed to be angry, irrespective of what political side of the aisle you might land on. But it's a lot of people are conditioned. And I think that's the right term for it, right? That social media and you know, TV media and algorithms have kind of pushed content our way. These algorithms aren't dumb. They know if you watch something and you watch another thing like it, that's what it's going to dump into you. So we have so many people that are just pissed every day, John T. And so I love that you're talking about you wanted more love in your life. I mean, that's beautifully said.
I think about this a lot when I travel, and you know, it's always at an airport, even if you're just doing a quick hop, there's stress. I mean, it is a moment of heightened awareness and often a kind of harried way of moving through the world is moving through an airport. And it stresses me out. And I think about that a lot because I look at the person sprinting past me to catch a plane. They're as stressed out as I am, or maybe even more so. And so when I move through an airport, especially, it's like the place I try to practice this most. It's to embrace that idea of, you know, we talked about microaggressions were much in parlance a while back. And I try to think about microkindnesses. How can I, in small moments, be kind to other people, look up in the airport and meet somebody's eye? You know, when I'm standing at the rental counter, ask somebody about how their day is and really mean it, not in a perfunctory way, actually ask them. Those moments might be of some small help to the person receiving them, but they're a huge help to me because they remind me of who I can be if I step out of that frustrating, kind of harried moment of the airport and see somebody else as a human walking right past me.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. I had a guest on my show several years ago, John O'Leary, who wrote a book that looked at why child have this wonderment and why we as adults lose it and we become so focused on differences. And he described sitting on an airplane and talking about somebody he had nothing in common with. But he got down to, well, we both breathe oxygen, right? Yep. We both eat food, right? Yep. So, you know, there was some commonality there. And I've never heard anybody say micro-kindness, but that's fantastic. I mean, that's the whole premise of the show, is getting people to be kind to each other, you know, to be intentional. You know, there's a lot of things we can control, and a lot of things we can't. We can't control the weather. We can't control the stock market. We can't control if countries decide to shoot rockets at each other, but we can always control how we choose to treat other people.
And that idea of being intentional is important because I backslide all the time. I get just as damn frustrated as I do, you know, in a normal day, but then I stop myself and try to remember, like, this helps me and it helps you. You know, I think about all the different things I try to do. I find myself not often accomplishing what I'm attempting, but I keep trying.
It's one of these things, you're never going to get a certificate in the mail. Congratulations, John T. You are the most kind you are ever going to be, right? But it's aspirational. But as long as we make the effort, we get there. This is such a fun conversation, John T. I want to talk about a part of the book where things started going south, no pun intended. You had created the Southern Foodway Alliance. This really, you know, elevated your career, and you became the authority, like the cultural authority, and then you faced backlash. And so I know that that was crushing to you, but what did that teach you about authenticity and accountability?
It taught me about awareness first, I think. You know, one of the things, I didn't recognize how much power I had. I worked in a fairly small world, food culture within the American South and broadly across the country. But when you wield power in a certain sphere, that power creates frictions and creates problems for others, no matter what your intent might be. And I wasn't enough aware of that. The other thing that I took away from that moment was that, and I write about this in the book pretty extensively, is that I think many of us who work in nonprofit fields or other efforts that try to make the place you live better, whether that's the church or a nonprofit or a non-governmental organization, whatever it is, that can lead to kind of a hubristic stance on the part of the person who does that. At the farthest extent, a kind of messianic stance that, you know, I and I alone are out to save the world. I'm not saying that's the stance I took, but I believe that in that moment when I was riding high and I believed myself to be a good actor in the play, was right when I lost sight of my own goals and my hubris undid me.
I had a professor in graduate school who told me that if you were in the helping profession at all, whether you're a therapist or a psychologist or a coach, whatever you are, there has to be a little bit of that grandiosity, that hubris there to believe that you're so talented that you, just by being you, can make a difference in people's lives. But, you know, this was something that you built. It crumbled around. You know, you, I'm sure, no pun intended, had a chapter called Reconstruction.
Yeah.
you know, you're essentially, your life's work had tumbled to ashes around you. What did you learn about yourself in terms of resilience and reinvention, and then how do we apply that to others, do you think?
I guess the main thing I took away from, like, I had a wreck in the year 2018, and the way I write it about in the book, you know, this was the second wreck, and this one occurred in 2020. And in both cases, I recognized that I wouldn't be the same on the other side of what happened. In the case of the wreck, I've got, you know, an ankle that still swells with blood when I'm standing, and a knee that's not dependable. And yet, the thing I took away from that wreck, and the thing I took away from the second wreck, is that that what's really important is what I do on the other side of that. It's not how I react to that, but how I act on the other side of that. Do I let that moment drag me down? Do I carry anger for what, you know, the woman who hydroplaned across the road on ball tires and, you know, slammed head force into my little Mini? Or do I think about the ways in which I can be better on the other side? Do I focus on what the ways in which each of those wrecks were wake-up calls for me? Do I embrace the possibilities on the other side? And do I measure myself by what can I do next? That seems to me the big life lesson that I took away. And they were very different moments, but they taught me the same thing, that, you know, it's almost like, what belief might you carry up and out of the hardest moment that you have, and what good can you do with that belief?
I'm smiling as you're telling me this, because this is almost identical to the line of thinking I had when I had my car accident, and you know, mine was pretty rough. It was right by a Waffle House in Atlanta. And I think when things like that happen to you, you're right. Like my verbiage around that is, you have two choices. You either can ball your fist up at the sky and blame whatever deity you choose to believe in, or you can say, what are the lessons? What can I learn? You know, I didn't, like you, you know, it was a woman who hydroplaned and just lost control of her car. In my instance, it was a 17-year-old kid who just wasn't paying attention and ran a red light when I was turning left, right? And in both instances, long-term issues. But if you held a gun to my head and asked me what was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life, to that point in my life, that would have been it, because it totally shifted how I view things. And so, you know, I loved reading and learning about, you know, how your adversity impacted you, because in the end, you know, we don't have the crystal ball in front of us, but your life is in a much better place. And I'm sure you're doing in alignment with what, you know, your heart and soul really yearned for you to do, which is awesome. Before we wrap, John T, tell me about True South.
Sure thing. So it's a show about identity in the modern South. Usually the show revolves around two restaurants we set in conversation, one with the other, to get at some bigger truth about the place we're exploring. That formula can vary, but at its core, it's an examination of the South in the modern moment, an attempt to actually see this place for what it is, to sidestep the myths and the moonlight and the magnolias.
The book is called House of Smoke. It's available everywhere. John T., our time has just flown by. I looked at the clock and I cannot believe how quickly this has flown by. You have dropped some pearls of wisdom on us today. I'm grateful for that. As you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests a single question. And that is, what is your biggest helping? That one most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation today?
To not save the word love for the people who are your blood kin, to tell your friends, people you admire, to tell them you love them and why, and to mean it, like to dig down and figure out why.
Well said. For those of you in the car, we got you covered. I'm going to link to the book in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. But John T., if people want to learn more about you, where can they find you on the internet?
I'm kind of everywhere, which is, I don't mean that as hubris itself, but johntedge.com, you can find all the links and all the things.
Fantastic. Well, John T., I have enjoyed our conversation so much today.
Myself, Dr. Richard.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And to those of you listening to this at home or wherever you are, if you liked it, if you're inspired, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on your podcast app of choice, because this is what helps other people find the show. And thank you for spending some time with us today. But most importantly, go out there and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post it in your social media feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.